So here we are, back to the baseline. Our guest today is Carlos Dengler. Did I say that correctly?
You most certainly did.
I'm so proud of myself.
Me too.
Truly honored to have you here, sir. You are one of my favorite bass players currently.
Currently.
Well, the last 20 years, you know.
Oh, okay, I see.
You.
Because I haven't, there's been nary a bass line in.
Yes, exactly.
7 years, so I don't know.
I think that I feel honored and lucky that you're sitting here with me to sort of hunt you down. I feel like I had to be a detective and hire an outsource.
My email is readily available to the entire world.
Great. Is it still awesomebassplayer@gmail?
No, I changed that one to deludedfreak@gmail.com.
Okay, cool. Is there an X at the end?
Of freak?
A freak, yeah.
Oh, yes. Then I changed it to deluded freaks.
Got it. Yeah, exactly.
With two E's.
So Carlos played bass in the band Interpol. He hasn't done an interview in a long time, so we're very happy that you're here. Speaking of happy that you're here, you grew up in Queens, right? You were born in Queens. Did you grow up in Queens?
I did. Elmhurst, Queens. I was born in Flushing Hospital.
Nice. Did you grow up with a scene? Did you come to the Lower East Side? Did you grow up? What was your music?
No.
Connection.
It was
from Queens too.
All anger, and thankfully, just at the moment when, basically, it was the time when Hysteria came out.
Right, Def Leppard Hysteria.
Yeah. So 87, basically the apex of that whole top 40 metal. It was when metal was becoming mainstream.
Right. Hair metal, pop metal.
All of it.
Hippity-hoppity metal.
Indeed. There was no hippity-hoppity metal yet. That's sort of like new metal.
Right.
Although I've never called it hippity-hoppity metal.
You heard it. We coined the phrase here today, right?
Excellent. Glad to be a part of it. Yeah, and I was just, it was a depressing experience to grow up in Elmhurst, Queens in the 80s. And metal, specifically Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath, Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, more of the heavy stuff. I'd also listen to Dokken and Never Poison. That stuff really gave me the only voice that was available to me at that time. And my entire life just became about metal, about growing my hair, ripping my jeans. And that was back then when those things meant something, actually.
Right, there's consequence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not like now where it's another sort of permutation of the diaspora of fashion that we now know in the 21st century. So back then, if you ripped your jeans and you grew your hair and you wore like a messed up t-shirt with like a skull on it, it was like, whoa, this guy's a fucking freak. Can I curse on here?
Why not?
I'll try to keep it at a minimum. And it was a time when if you decided to go that route, it meant something.
Right.
And it meant the world to me back then. So that's what I grew up with.
It's interesting that you said that years ago I went to Japan and loved it, had a great time with the band I was playing at the time, and we were all obsessed with how hyperculture the kids were. If you were a punk Japanese kid in Tokyo, you were the ultimate punk. If you were into hip-hop, you were your style was based on the details of everything, and we were blown away that they had analyzed and critiqued and absorbed punk culture or metal culture too, or 50s culture, whatever it was, perfectly.
It's an homage.
It was an homage. Perfect.
It's not they're importing all of this. So they have to amplify whatever it is that they're importing just to kind of bait it into their heads. You know, we don't need to do that. We live with it. We are the creators of that.
Right, but there was no consequence. It was sort of this alarming, I grew up in D.C. and there were skinheads and D.C. punk was happening. I'd go to a show and, 30%, 45% of the time, some skinhead might walk up to me and put his foot next to my shoe and go, "What size shoe are you? I'm taking your boots." And to be a kid in junior high or high school, and that was intense, but I had to go to the show. I had to scream. I had to just say,
That's a great point, actually.
And now I go to shows and I sort of stand there and people sort of holding their beer and talking and the phones are out. And I'm like, did someone come and take their phone? Like, what kind of phone you have, buddy? And
no, I mean, that
it's just, they're standing there watching
a
show.
We're living in Disney World right now. There's no, the security is on it, you know?
I saw this band Savages recently and I was so impressed by their audience because their audience, I felt like, was 35 and up and there were no phones out. There was no one.
Huh.
So they were just listening to the music and focusing on their structures and their performance and the whole experience. I was like, this is a great show. And I kind of left going, I don't know if I like Savages, but I just like the whole thing that I just saw. I actually do like Savages, but I found
you
myself.
You mean people listening?
Yeah, people just standing there and listening, like paying attention. Superchunk played a couple, about a year ago at Barry Ballroom, and same kind of situation. Audience was mostly older, understood the career of Superchunk, and everyone's just watching and screaming and being a part of the show, which is, I imagine, how it was for you growing up as well. If you saw a show or you listened to a record, people would come over and listen to the record.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean we could spend hours talking about the fundamental... the differences between consumption of music today compared to even when Interpol was out in the early aughts is an existential difference.
Correct.
It's the way it's before you even listening to it, your mind is already in a completely different place than it was when we released our very first records.
It's funny. In junior high, I had a girlfriend, and we bought this Right to Spring record, this band from D.C., Right to Spring.
Yeah, I remember
sort of
them.
The first, quote, emo band, which is a terrible title to give them, but unfortunately, they're sort of connected to it. But we would go and listen in her room, we'd just listen to the record over and over again, and I just remember her going, okay, you can get up now and flip the record. And I was like, okay.
I love that memory is so specific for you.
Yeah, it was such a specific, everything about it, like I felt so excited. I was in her room, lying on her bed, and we just sort of lit, sort of a scene from a movie.
I had a crash course in this difference. So that's like what you just described is one side of the spectrum. And I experienced the opposite side recently whenever my classmates in acting school, who are, for all express purposes, millennials, would throw a party and I would go and they would just play music like the first 2 minutes, the first chorus and maybe some of the second verse of every song, and then just flip to the next song,
right?
Because they've heard enough.
Yeah, and of course, not to bore you with financials, but YouTube or Spotify, they don't pay anything until the song ends.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, some music streaming services pay after 30 seconds, but most of them pay till the song ends. So I don't know how many times a millennial is like, I'm going to listen to the very last beep of this thing. No, you're DJing in a car. Let me DJ now. Let's go find this Modest Mouse song. Oh, this song is more than 35 seconds. Let's go to the Interpol song.
Exactly. Yeah. I got what I needed.
Right.
And it's so easy for me to click to the next one that I can get what I need on the next one.
Yeah, there's no flipping.
It's vampiric.
yeah, there's no flipping of the record.
Yeah, the natural sort of obstacle that, or the impracticality, we could say, of listening to a record or even a CD, which was when they came out, they were labeled as much more practical than vinyl, which they are, but compared to today, we might as well lump them in with vinyl. But those natural obstacles actually presented... it gave the artist behind it gave the creator of the content of the vinyl or of the CD a little bit of power over the listener. It gave the creator the ability to say, listen, I need you to listen to me. So not so fast.
Right.
Like, put the stylus on the record. Now sit back. And in 20 minutes, you're going to have to change me over. So like, make sure you're paying attention. So there was like a relationship there.
Correct.
And what I found when the MP3s really started to take hold, which I think was around the time that the third Interpol record came out, is I started to feel, as being one of those creators, I started to feel the loss of control over that. And I needed that. I needed to know that when I was recording something, that implicit in that creation, there was an agreement between myself and the audience that they would be paying attention in a certain way. And when I started to see that slip, it was heartbreaking.
I think it's a really good point, because Turn On the Bright Lights, the first record, it's such a journey. It's such a beautiful tapestry. It's a journey. And
that's the way we did all our records.
Correct. But it's interesting that you bring that up, because as the Interpol's anthology and their records, as a listener, I found that there's almost a disruption, that I either unconsciously started picking out, or go through the record and be like, oh, I know they want me to listen to this, but you know what? I like this song, Come Here. It attacks me. I want to go for run. This is the best thing for this situation. Versus I still come back to Turn On the Bright Lights for the experience of it.
So you would say that Bright Lights has more of a kind of noticeable thread, like a sort of narration, as opposed to, let's say, Antics or...
I think it's a really good question. I hope I'm not insulting your music.
No,
please. I think maybe where my head was at, where I was emotionally, where I was at, I was in New York. I was in a band. I felt connected to this sort of new scene that has sort of, with the Yeah Yeahs and Interpol, and there's all these bands that were popping up. I felt connected to that. So I was paying attention more. I wanted people to pay attention to the music that Le Savoy Fa was making. And we were all sort of, hey, here's Gang of Four, here's Joy Division, here are all these references that people were pulling from. But it was interesting that you say that. But yeah, as MP3s and as the music business and how we consume music year after year started happening, I succumbed to the same thing that I hate.
I know. And well, I'm a slave to my smartphone, yeah. That's the diabolical aspect of all of this technology, is that it's, even those of us that, I consider it my civil responsibility to cry out every day against this sort of dictatorship, but yet I am a slave as well.
Yeah. But to answer your question, I felt that Bright Lights, when I put that record on, that... I find myself having more patience, more peace, knowing like, oh, this is a book. I'm going to read all the pages.
More than Antics? More than Our Love to Admire?
For me personally, again, it people are like, oh, when The Story of Five would play a show, people are like, oh, play that song off your first record, or play the song off your second record. And then I always ask them, where were you in your life? Oh, I got late to that song. Oh, I just graduated from college. So people have their connections to different records at different times, I'm sure. If you ask someone about Antics that is younger than me, they're like, oh no, that's my favorite record by far. Mm-hmm. There's no question. Mm-hmm. But I think where I was at the time, that connected in even your bass lines, going back to the bass line, I was just blown away at how you thought about your bass lines on that specific record. On Bright Lights. It was something that was so familiar and yet so original. I talked to other bass players and I was like, oh, who's your favorite bass player? And those bass lines always come back to sort of your peer group. And, I don't know if you're aware of that, but, I was talking to a friend of mine who was a bass player in Block Party. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay.
Great guy. And he was just basically saying, oh yeah.
Manny.
No, his name is Gordon.
Gordon, oh, sorry. Why did I think Manny? Who's Manny?
I don't know.
Gordon, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Now I remember you.
We can edit this out. So Gordon, the bass, because I spaced out, so I got Gordon, the bass player at Block Party, who is now living in Texas. We were discussing sort of our favorite bass players, and your name came up as well. So just how you approached, obviously Peter Hook is a reference, and Simon Gallup is a reference.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But you added something else to that, and I want to sort of get back to who were your influences growing up besides, obviously I hear those, but there's other elements, there's a dance element, you explore the neck in a way that most people don't, and how you sort of, you pick and choose space in, and I think that it, without your bass lines in Interpol would never be where they are. I think Paul has good lyrics and it's interesting and there's something to talk about there. But I think what's been missing from the things I've read about those records are you know, you as a musician, I think it's interesting. I've always wanted to ask you, be like, where were you at? What was that thought? Because, you know, the droning of the guitar is very one way, but then it's your bass lines that come in that make these songs so brilliant. So just take that in, I just rambled at you.
You know, that is a fantastic question. First, there's certain, there are two main, I mean, there are many, but I think the two big factors that pop into my mind are actually, they're not very sexy, they're just very practical. One is that I grew up as a guitarist, so, and heavy metal was sort of my cri de coeur, if you will. So my whole orientation, my very earliest orientation around music was around anger, around volume, around power chords, around chugga 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 chugga. So, you know, and I used to wail. In fact, I still can, just a little bit. And I'm very proud of that. I can finger tap and all of that sort of stuff. So I did a fair amount of shredding growing up. And I put the guitar down. At a certain point in time, I decided I didn't want to do any music anymore. I just wanted to listen to classical music. And I was going to pursue this fantasy of being a philosophy professor, and which is why I went to NYU, which is where I met the band, and so on and so forth. So when I was asked by Daniel to play the bass, because that was the position for hire, of course, you know, I was in a mood of experimentation, having just moved to New York, and I just felt like, yeah, why not? Fuck, I'm DJing at WNYU. I'm going to this cultural event. I'm going to these nightclubs. I'm in NYU. I'm hot shit. Why not? Let me try doing all these things. So Interpol actually was just one of many things that I was interested in, and then the rest is history. But because for me, it was more just, the only thing that I could offer was what I knew, and what I knew was guitar. So naturally, the bass for me at that time felt somewhat of an impediment. It was missing two strings. Right. It didn't have the expressive capabilities of the guitar. And so I had to make do with what was given to me. So that's factor number one. The second factor is that, just as it so happened, Daniel's style of playing, and he was the one who would kind of come in with the, like, sort of like this on a cellular level, like just a basic melody, just like a one string kind of melody, but it had a certain je ne sais quoi or whatever that he had, and like he had a certain reverb effect, and the guitar itself had a certain hollow body kind of aspect to it that was very attractive in its simplicity, and it's just kind of like in its simplicity. And I think that simplicity, the fact that for whatever reason Daniel came to the mix with not a finished product, he knew, like, this wasn't going to be the chord progression of the song, this was not going to be, like, he didn't even know what the finished thing, he just knew that he kind of liked the way this melody sounded, gave me, with my kind of like
assignment,
yes, and also the impediment, you could, you know, quote unquote, the impediment of the bass, to then try to make up for what was already quote unquote missing. And so then this created this sort of like this thing that you hear in almost every Interpol song, which is kind of like a DNA strand, a helix, you know, between the bass and Daniel's guitar.
Well, here's, and you play a jazz. That was your,
and then of course the jazz guitar is the natural instrument to go to for that sort of thing.
Right. And then my question is, why not a five-string bass, or, you know, a guy who plays...
Okay, so then at the time, I was discovering goth music for the first time, and by way of goth, new wave and post-punk. So I was kind of letting go of, like... And this was, you know, the late 90s, so... We still haven't developed this sort of polyglot kind of appreciation for music that we have today. So things were still sort of etched in stone, and like metal wasn't really a very cool medium back then. And we were still somewhat in the grunge era, still kind of recovering from Kurt Cobain's death and so on and so forth. So all of a sudden I started discovering this other music that had been forgotten from the early 80s and the mid 80s. And I was like, oh yeah, and The Cure, like I used to love The Cure growing up, but I just couldn't admit it to myself because right. I was too obsessed with Megadeth.
Right.
So now I had this permission to kind of go back to this other music. I was going out to nightclubs that were playing 80s music all the time. I was dressing up like a goth. I was discovering that aesthetic. Now that aesthetic to me is very much rooted in punk music.
Correct.
In a kind of like, I don't want to worry about what my amp sounds like or what my amp settings right. are about. So for a 5-string bass or any other kind of variation on a bass, would seemed a little too...
Affected,
jazzy, or like established.
Right.
You know, established bassists play those instruments. But correct. I was like, I'm a snot-nosed, like street urchin, punk rock kid. Like, right. I don't have time for a 5-string bass. That was sort of my attitude back then.
Interesting. I know that you studied philosophy at NYU, and then you were in Interpol, and then the last 5 years you've been studying acting. Tell me, do you find your sort of philosophical, the ideas that you studied in school applied to the bass that are now applying to your acting career? Because they're all very different, but somehow kind of the same.
I hope so. The
bass player has to be... you know, I feel like a guitar player or singer, the philosophy of those instruments voices is very different than the idea of the bass player.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm still learning so much about myself and the decisions and the choices that I've made in my life. One common thread that I am kind of noticing now is that I'm very... there's like a cynicism about me, and I use my analytical capabilities to kind of get in touch with that cynicism. So I kind of like to be aloof.
Right.
There's a degree of aloofness. I think I definitely learned that being a philosophy major in NYU. Oddly enough, I now know, I used to always kind of say like, man, if I would have just stuck with that philosophy career, oh God, I'd be the rock star of philosophy professors now instead of the rock star of rock stars.
Right.
And now I'm looking back a little bit more maturely and sort of saying, that wasn't the right life for me. I don't think that I belong in a cloistered kind of really grid-like analytical environment. I'm an artist and I need that freedom. And you don't get that freedom being a philosophy major, but it did give me like a certain analytical tool set, which I then used in Interpol, like to create my image and my whole like attitude and my whole Weltanschauung, if you right. will.
I'm gonna have to look that word up.
What I think you can do is just put like a little title card, like real quick.
Okay.
Like, I mean, I could define it for you, but I think you'll take care of it.
I want more. Actually, I will enjoy going and looking at that.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, what happens is once a narrative starts to take hold, I got to jump ship.
Right.
And I did that with philosophy. Because then I jumped ship onto the Interpol train.
Right.
And then once Interpol's narrative started to get, this is what we do and this is who we are and this is the business and it goes like this and we now are doing the next album and the next tour and so on and so forth. I construe that as an attack on my autonomy.
Right.
And this is not a pleasant life to pursue, and I'm very much experiencing that these days, that this type of living is excessively difficult. But I did that. I had to jump that ship. And then I wanted to start a new narrative, which was like, all right, let me take all of that experience and throw it into my acting.
Right.
And I've been fortunate enough to get the best training that that an actor could possibly hope for.
Did you do undergrad for?
I had my undergrad degree in philosophy.
Right, sure,
then I just kind of did a quick 2-year kind of beginner course, and then I got accepted into NYU MFA, which is one of the most competitive programs. And so now I fancy myself a certified actor, and looking for work and all of that sort of stuff. And it's just been an interesting ride.
It sounds awesome. I have one last question for you. Do you have a favorite bass line that you keep coming back to? that when you pick up the bass, you're sort of unconscious, like, oh, I'm playing PDA, or I'm playing Khmer,
or an Interpol.
Or even another, like, a Black Sabbath song, or a Dawkins song. Is there something that you're just like, when you pick up the bass, do you still love the bass? Do you have are you done with the bass, or do you still pick up, like, oh my God, this feels good?
Look, I mean, I'm not exactly proud to say this, but I have not owned a bass in my entire life. There was a crappy bass in Daniel's apartment when we were jamming at Funkadelic in 97 that we used. I then borrowed my brother's bass. He had a really nice jazz bass. Then the band made enough money where we could use the band funds to, and then from that point forward, I was just, and so when I left the band, I didn't take, and then because I just jumped right into acting, I said, oh, I need a break from music. I literally haven't played the bass in almost 7 years. And
you know, we have a bass here.
So let's do it. So I don't, and as I said, I mean, I have guitars at home, and I pluck away on those every once in a while too. I mean, my whole relationship with music is still in flux, but the bass, as I said, I was a guitarist coming into this, so I never really had that kind of emotional attachment to the instrument.
Right.
I will say that having been in a famous rock band for 10 years and having to become good at that instrument because of that experience, I do miss some of the very particular ways of expressing oneself that are particular to that instrument.
Yes.
I really miss it. And we shall see where that takes me.
Well, I look forward to hearing those bass lines in the future. And Carlos, thank you so much for being part of Back to the Bass Lines podcast.
You're very welcome. It was an absolute pleasure, Sid.
I hope I didn't scare you too much.
I hope I didn't scare you too much.
No, but I'm going to have to go look up some of the words that we discussed.
Yes, Weltanschauung being the chief one that is obscure.
That's a great one. I'll have to figure out how to spell it.
I'll tell you how to spell it.
Okay, after the show. Thanks again so much. Thanks for listening. Bye.